Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show...
Farfetch has always believed that the physical retail space is here to stay, it just needed technology to augment it.
Will an online retail giant shape the future of luxury brick-and-mortar shops? Next...
Our expectation of HDB flat is like a minimum things that we have for life kind of things. But when we get to home, our stereotyped image was completely broken.
We head behind the sheer walls of Singapore's ubiquitous Housing Development Board apartment blocks and meet a pair of photographers who have captured an intimate portrait of home life in the city-state. Plus, architecture on the move, a look at mobile solutions to the built environment, and an illuminating chat with a lighting designer from San Francisco. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, since starting in 2008, Farfetch has become one of the most successful online fashion startups. It works by providing a backlit platform on which retailers can sell their wares without having to invest in an expensive site of their own. Now, founder José Neves and team are eyeing up how physical, proper shopping can bolster their business. At an event at London's Design Museum earlier this month, the brand revealed the prototype for Farfetch OS, a way of using data gathered online to recommend items to shoppers in physical retail environments. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the launch to find out more. He began by speaking to Stephanie Fair, the Chief Strategy Officer for Farfetch.
So I think what often people don't realize with big, successful tech companies is that they've taken a while to get to where they have. José launched Farfetch end of 2008 on a very simple idea, which was how could technology and the internet enable these boutiques that were in all sorts of remote parts of the world to leverage a global audience. And people were starting to think in a global way. And that same idea has carried through in everything that Farfetch has done over the last 8-9 years. And that strong mission statement, which we define as to be the global platform for luxury, remains now. So all new innovation and everything that Farfetch does in future relates back to that mission. And I think that's the genius of José as an entrepreneur. It's a very simple statement, but it informs the future. Store of the Future is a big plan for Farfetch in 2017 and 18. And Store of the Future is the evolution of that original platform premise. Store of the Future is essentially saying we've connected these boutiques and brands, we've put them online, we've given them an online audience. Now, how do we enable that same data and that same service that you get online in terms of personalization and recommendations, how can we actually bring that to the physical retail space? And Farfetch has always believed that the physical retail space is here to stay. It just needed technology to augment it. And Store of the Future is that technology. It's a suite of tools and technologies which boutiques and brands can choose to take everything or parts of it or bring third parties into it. The common goal is to capture data about the customer between their online and their offline journey to give them a better service.
Sandrine Deveau, MD of the Store of the Future, tells me a bit more about the concept of the shop.
So what you're going to see today is just a beta version of the Store of the Future project. Our tech team has been working over the last 18 months on selecting a few technology, and obviously this is just for the purpose of this event. So let's have a look at the first step of the journey. I'm going to show you, two things. We're going to look at the experience when a customer enters the stores between myself with the customers and Ferrari is playing the role of the sales associate. So we start with these key facts where we know that 90% of the sales are still happening in store. However, digital is still influencing a lot of our purchase decision. So really trying to find out how we can replicate this online behavior in store and really start to create that single customer view. So this morning we had Bain, was talking about data privacy, and they were telling us as over 75% of customers are happy to give data to brands they trust in exchange of value. So what we looked at, different types of technology in the market for customer recognition, like eye beacons or camera sensors, as we believe is really important for brands to be transparent with customers how they use the data. If you look at you, for example, the way you're actually sharing your data online, you're accepting cookies, you're looking on the website, so which is why this is kind of a common behavior. So we concluded it's really important to give the customer the choice to either opt-in or opt-out in the service they want to receive.
Farfetch commissioned a research at consulting firm Bang & Company about their customers and their behavior when it comes to shopping. I spoke to Claudia D'Arpizio from Bang & Company about her findings.
I think that the physical space will still have a very big role in fashion, but not in the way we are seeing the store now. So for sure, the e-commerce and mobile commerce is taking a big share, and digital is influencing the majority of the transaction, and also is really making the opinions, creating the opinions and the consideration. But the physical store is still a big role because of the proximity and because it's the epicenter of what the brand can deploy. So including technology into the store in a seamless way with all the applications and the online application can be a way to really to merge the best of the two worlds.
And finally, Stephanie Fair, Farfetch's Chief Strategy Officer, tells me when the first store of the future will open.
There is a rollout plan. The first step of it is to actually roll out Store of the Future within Browns. That was one of the key ideas behind the acquisition of Browns, which was how can we use Browns as a laboratory of ideas for new retail technologies. So that will be around September time, will be a beta within Browns. Tom Brown, the brand, has signed on as the first exclusive pilot partner for Store of the Future, which we're very excited about. And the idea is to really roll it out across the network of Farfetch partners. And my sense is that we will get a lot of inbound requests after today.
Stephanie Farr there, Chief Strategy Officer for Farfetch, speaking to Monocle's ever-dapper Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You can find out more at farfetchos.com. Over to Singapore now, where over 80% of residents live in the rectangular blocks developed by the city-state's National Housing Development Board. Recently, a Japanese team made up of photographer and architect Tomohisa Miyauchi and the husband and wife artist duo Eitaro Ogawa and Tamai Iwasaki published a massive photographic tome documenting the private spaces behind the city-state's ubiquitous public housing flats. The book unveils a diversity of individual creativity that's bloomed behind the closed doors of the seemingly characterless units. Monocle's intrepid Ziana Zulkifli visited the trio in, where else but Eitaro and Tamai's four-room HDB flat in Singapore.
Story four.
Hello. My name is Tamae. I work at SCPI, Singapore Tyler Print Institute, as an art educator.
My name is Eitaro Ogawa. I'm also working at the Singapore Tyler Print Institute as a project leader and chief printer.
Hi, my name is Tomohisa Miyauchi. Please call me Tomo. I'm a senior lecturer at the Department of Architecture, National University of Singapore. I'm an architect, trained by architect, but I was interesting to take a picture of HDB flats, so I contributed as a photographer, mainly as a photographer, and also as an editor of the book.
Yes, this is like a 4.9 kg book that we made, so we never expected so big and heavy. This book is started when Eitaro and myself were looking for HDB flat to purchase. That is about 7 years ago, because we are like living quite long in Singapore, and then we decided to purchase one, but we didn't know much about HDB flat. The image of HDB flat was not really great in the beginning, because it looks quite similar each other, and sometimes that we look up to the HDB flat and we don't even know that how the livings, individual livings are. and it just looked too uniform. And we are working in the art field, and it was scared me a little bit to live in one of this very rigid and uniform flat.
That first flat that inspired you, can you just tell me a little bit about it?
Okay. The first flat we visited was our friend's who is teaching art in the school. Our expectation of HDB flat is a lot of concrete, very rigid, uniformed, and not so lively in a way. It's like a minimum things that we have for life kind of things. But when we get to home, it was shining with a lot of sunlight, a lot of windows, open air, and his flat was the top floor of the HDB. Yeah, you can just flip the book. And that was the really, really eye-opening. Another thing, I felt about HDB flat is away from nature. But in fact, when we went into his room, a lot of breeze and the park nearby, I can see a lot of greens. And it's so close to nature. And you know, that there is a one house style that in Singapore is a kampong house, which I think is almost disappearing right now. But I could immediately imagine that kampong spirit in this house. Very easy to associate with, very lively, and close to the natures. And I can see a lot of neighborhood very close to his house. So I think that's made us a strong, strong impression that what HDB can be, and our stereotyped image was completely broken.
Though the team started the project with a focus on well-designed homes, they eventually expanded the brief wide open. Out of plain curiosity, they wanted to peek into less manicured domains to get to the substance of life in Singapore, even if it meant getting messy. Sometimes called knocking on doors, Tamae, Eitaro, and Tomo were pleasantly surprised by how many people let them in. As an architect fascinated by how people use their private spaces, Tomo was especially thrilled and explains how the diversity of Singapore's living spaces came to be.
As an architect, I was always interested in seeing the cities and seeing the where people live. And coming to Singapore, and I start looking at where people live, right? When we started the project, I was just still like maybe a few months in Singapore, and or maybe just like 1 year in Singapore, and I was really interested in how people live here. And after understanding like 80% of people live in public housing, which really kind of struck me as an architect, because any public housing in the world, very different from the kind of public housing in Singapore in terms of the ownership model. You say this is a public housing, but actually people in Singapore can own these flats. So it become sort of their own sort of flat house, and then it becomes their own neighborhood.
We visited like 118 flats, and then everybody has their own style of decorating place. Of course, different races, different religions, they are completely different. Generally, it's quite clean. But I find that an Indian family likes that. It's fake flowers a lot and colorful walls. It's really like bright, you know, places. And in the Chinese family, there is a golden bowl rolling. And it's fine that it's like they just go for something that they really like. And it's not need to, how to say, follow everybody's trend or everybody's common sense, you know. I think it's in Japan, because we are from Japan, we kind of have a common sense that this is the beauty in Japan. And we kind of check each other, and this is good, and this is not really good. So there is some kind of standard. But here, it's just everybody go for whatever they like, and which is so interesting. Every time you step in, and they have their own way of creating home, is really diverse.
Tomohisa Miyauchi, Eitaro Ogawa, and Tamai Iwasaki there, speaking to Monocle's Zayana Zulkifli about their incredible new book, HDB Homes of Singapore. Now, people are more mobile than ever, and architecture, that seemingly immovable medium, is responding to the challenges with ideas, accommodation options, and plain avant-garde musings. In her new book, Mobitecture, Rebecca Roque catalogues over 250 works of mobile architecture, ranging from wearable tents to cabins in the Dolomites that are mounted on skis. She joined the show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, in studio to talk about the world of mobile architecture.
There's probably two main reasons as to why it continues to be popular. And the first one really is the sort of sense of freedom and adventure and having a respite from the usual sort of routines of day-to-day life, that having a mobile home, be it a tent or a caravan or an RV or whatever it might be, they're sort of adaptable, lightweight, they're easily moved, and so people can change their backdrop easily. And the second reason, which I think is probably a bit more recent, but it sort of gained appeal from about 2007 onwards, is the tiny house movement, which is basically small mobile homes, usually around or less than 700 square feet. And especially in America, after the crash and the recession, I think that's really gained momentum, and that's become like a whole niche, admittedly, but a movement in itself.
Can I just jump in here? So the tiny house movement, is it an official kind of codified organisation?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a bit more about that.
It's primarily American-based, and that's something that I found when I was doing the research for the book. There's just an endless amount of people fascinated in it, in the idea of living in a small space that they can move around. And also, I think the financial consideration, people who basically either had, you know, huge defaults on mortgages or really made them think, well, you know, we're beholden to this sort of system of large spaces and huge mortgages. What can we actually do that's realistic and practical? And it's just become this really quite popular niche, admittedly, but still quite popular. And also, I think in media coverage and things like that, there's books about it, there's blogs, there's magazines, you know, it is quite a popular and well-known phenomenon, especially there.
Flicking through the book, I also detected a quite strong political motivation running through many of the designs in the first place and many of the reasons people choose to live in these mobile homes as well.
Yes.
You know, what are the conditions that have given rise to that?
I mean, there was definitely a consideration in terms of what I selected and decided to include. But I think it also sort of pairs up with a growing consideration or interest by design graduates and architects, civilians also, who are actually starting to look at real world problems and questioning how we can apply design principles and take on these sorts of concerns, and also have, you know, qualities of design and thoughtfulness around how you deal with them. And I guess urban migration is probably one of the key ones that sort of kept popping up when I was looking around at different projects and deciding which ones to include. And that's going to be increasing. 3 million people roughly every week move into urban centres around the world.
And the idea is that mobile architecture might be able to alleviate some of the pressure that creates.
Yes, exactly. Especially in terms of homelessness. That's obviously also a growing concern with people, the influx into cities and how to actually facilitate comfortable living for people who have none. And so there's a couple of projects which I particularly like. One is a design by Hwang Kim called Cocoon, and he's an RCA graduate, and he basically sort of reconfigured a cardboard box, which is obviously something that homeless people often use as some kind of shelter. And he's basically rethought how you can take this simple material, apply a carefully thought through design in which it folds up and creates this elegantly designed, practical place for people to have privacy and to sleep safe with some more security.
And I think aside from those two political motivations that you've mentioned, which kind of alleviating pressure of migration and homelessness, I think an ecological concern is also something that motivates a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a couple. The environmental kind of migration is another theme that comes up through the book and is quite consistent across this idea of mobile architecture in terms of how do you accommodate people quickly, safely, well, giving them some sense of security in the face of climate disasters, environmental disasters. So, for example, there's some really thoughtful ideas in response to the Japanese earthquake and tsunami in 2011. And also in Spanish earthquakes, Architecture Global Aid, they're called, and they've basically looked at these different conditions and figuring out how you can provide. For them, they devise this origami paper house, which has different qualities depending on where it's used. But also, I think there's other ideas in Mobitecture where it's actually looking at the effect of climate change. So Walker Water is one of the projects in there, which was basically, it's like a net held with bamboo frames that can be set up. They were thinking in particular of Ethiopia, places where there's more and more pressure in terms of getting clean water. And it basically uses evaporative methods, but it also can be collapsed down, rolled and carried on someone's back to other difficult-to-get territory. So there's some quite thoughtful but also really practical examples of Mobitecture in the book.
The vast spectrum of designers' work represented in the book Mobitecture, they've all either assigned themselves the task or been assigned the task of designing a mobile habitation.
Yeah.
What are the particular design challenges posed by mobile architecture, do you think?
There's a few. I think one of the points really is it's often the Mobitecture is relatively limited in scale. It needs to be in order to be able to move with some kind of efficiency. And so the elements that are included inside the projects, in particular, I guess I'm thinking of the reworked RVs or the tiny homes, the common design question is how best to fit everything in. So stairs that also become stair treads that rise up to loft spaces that also have storage. So there's sort of these multi-use things or tables that fold away or slide away. That's definitely one of the key things of maximising space in these designs. And how you use light, the introduction of light in those sorts of spaces is also critical, especially when they're tiny. Being strategic about clerestory lighting or having whole sides that slide away or windows, doors, those sorts of strategies are quite prominent, I think, as well. And I think there's probably two other ones. The weight of the design, because of course it's going to be cycled or towed or carried or whatever it might be, comes into effect. How can you make something work using lightweight materials or lightweight construction methods? And also, for quite a lot of them, it's to do with the construction cost, because often they're either a secondary kind of place for leisure, therefore there's a sense of, you know, they're a luxury item in a way because it's not a principal dwelling, or else it's the choice to downsize and minimise the cost of living, and therefore all the components that are required to build these things often are salvaged, or they're using reclaimed materials, or the owners have, you know, taken on DIY project so that they can actually minimise the construction costs themselves. So, and in that way also I think there imparts quite a personality of the different designers and makers and so on that have been selected in the project itself.
Can you ever see mobile architecture becoming mainstream, or at least more mainstream than it is?
The tiny house movement is probably the closest to the mainstream that the mobile architecture is at the moment. And I think probably it's still a niche area, partly because we're so habituated to living in bricks and mortar, and also the size of spaces. Most people are quite happy having room to spread out and be fixed. But I think that, especially with mobile working becoming increasingly popular, I think it's about 14% of the population works in a mobile capacity. So that certainly gives people the opportunity to choose if they want to live, you know, life on the move. But I also think that it's a question of developers coming to the party too, really. And so far they haven't really picked up on or encouraged the trend. So the bricks and mortar option is the prevalent one. And certainly also for people with families, that makes it a little bit more complex to have life on the move if you're trying to school your kids and things like that. Not impossible, but more complicated.
Rebecca Roke there, talking about her new book, Mobitecture, Architecture on the Move, which is published by Fiden and available now. Now, plenty of products are physically designed in the major cities of the US and Europe, but far fewer of these products are actually made there. The pressure to outsource to cheaper locations for fabrication is simply too strong for many companies to resist. Not so, however, Eduardo Umana. A native of Colombia, Eduardo relocated to San Francisco to start his product design studio named Classic Engineering. His designs so far include a watch assembled in Switzerland and a brand new lampshade handmade in San Francisco. Eduardo recently visited Midori House and joined the show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, in studio to talk about his design process.
So I was sitting in math class, multivariable calculus, and the professor starts talking about this really interesting geometrical shape, a Mobius strip. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, this would make a beautiful lamp. And out of that idea came what became Classic Mobius. And Classic Mobius is not just a lamp. I wanted to create an enchanted object, something that was pretty magical. So this lamp turns on and off at the sound of a whistle. So you can activate it at a distance and, you know, add a little bit of something to your daily routine.
What do you think the lamp in its physical design and also that specific mechanism where it's turned on and off by a whistle, what does that add to or change about the user experience?
Well, the idea that I had for the lamp was, you put it somewhere in your house, and then when you come back from work or you come back to your house at night, you open the door and you whistle and there's this light, this beautiful light that turns on at a distance. That was the image that I had when I was thinking about this product. So what it is, it's a mix of how it makes you feel when you whistle. I think you feel happy because people whistle when they're happy, but it's also a pretty useful thing to be able to turn on and off a light at a distance by just whistling. It's a fun thing.
And tell me a little bit more about what it looks like and what it's made of.
So the lamp looks like a Mobius strip, and I know that that's a little bit not very useful, but it looks like two interlocked loops that twist. And the lamp is pretty big. I would say it's about 70 centimeters in length by about 50 centimeters in height. And it's made out of this really beautiful material. It's a man-made stone called solid surface. And it's this beautiful ceramic-like material that is white. And it's contrasted by cork. And the cork adds depth, warmth. It brings this homey feeling to the whole design of the lamp.
And it's not the first product you've made. You've developed some other products underneath the banner of your company, Classic Engineering. Tell me about those products and tell me about how they embody the philosophy behind Classic Engineering and what that philosophy is.
Yeah, so my first product is the Classic Vario. And you can notice a pattern here, the Classic Vario, Classic Mobius. So all the products will be Classic something. So the first product is a watch. And the design philosophy behind Classic Engineering is mixing engineering and art, which are my background. And by interlocking these two disciplines, engineering and art, I want to create beautiful products that would add, you know, a little bit of laughter to your day, a little bit of joy to your day. Just magical objects that will enhance your day-to-day sort of basis.
So the Classic Vario, is it? How would you call it?
Vario.
The Classic Vario.
Vario, yes.
And that's a watch, right?
It's a watch. And the reason that it's named Vario is because Vario comes, it's a root for a Latin word that it means to change. And you can exchange the straps and it's as easy as getting them in and out. And that was the whole inspiration for the Classic Vario. Just something that is very versatile. You can wear it with everything. It matches with everything that you might be wearing. And that's the reason why it's the Vario, because it changes.
You're based in San Francisco, and you've managed to make these products, not on your own entirely, but you put them together on your own, and you oversee the manufacturing, the fabrication of all the different parts. Tell me about your business model, your production model, and how you got there.
The products, I don't all assemble myself, so the watches are assembled in Switzerland. So that's a matter of just, you know, getting all the suppliers organized and having everything in Switzerland, hopefully at the same time, and all the parts machined well, made well, with very good quality. And then in Switzerland, they're assembled, and then the watches are sent back to the U.S. as a finished product. The lamps are a different product. The lamps are entirely handmade in San Francisco. I have a studio in downtown San Francisco, and I make the lamp in the studio, and it's a made-to-order product.
What is it about being based in San Francisco that changes the way you operate, or does the culture of the city influence the way you think about your business and your design?
I mean, yeah, San Francisco is the center of technology in all of the world. And my approach to technology has been very different of what people in the Valley are doing. So I have all these conversations with people of what is useful, what is not, what is intrusive, and what is not. There's this huge topic of privacy nowadays with things like Alexa and other products that are always listening to you, and they're always connected to the internet as well. So it's been very good to be able to sit in the center of technology and have a critical view of it and sort of try to filter what I like, what I don't like, and as a designer, what is useful, what is not useful, and what will actually improve our lives and what will not improve our lives in certain ways. So that is the position that I'm in San Francisco, and it's interesting.
Eduardo Umana there, and you can find out more about his company, Classic Engineering, at classic.engineering. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and this show's producer, the one and only Henry Rhys Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to badger Henry at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes, and feel free to leave us a review on the latter. It really does help people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and until next time, goodbye.